So this was just sort of a view from the trenches for those who have been doing the work or are doing the work or have been recently doing the work. And so basically you're sitting there and you're doing a numerical simulation and the thing blows up and you want to know why. And so we sat down and tried to just, you know, map out the basic ideas of what could be going wrong. One of them is your choice of gauge, and we're just going to call those gauge modes. So if something is blowing up in your code and it's not violating the constraint, we'll just call that a gauge mode because it's a solution of Einstein's equations, but it's ill-behaved in some sense. And for now, we're just going to ignore that. We'll come back to that later. Then you have what I will call constraint-violating modes, which I think the best way to understand those is as ill-behavior in your solution or your evolution scheme as you move slightly away from the constrained hypersurface. And this seems to be a major source of problems in the work that we've been doing. And then there's numerical instabilities, where you'll lump all of the problems that come out because, you know, you do some sort of discretization of the continuum equations, and there are various problems with that. And I don't think we want to discuss those at this meeting, because those are really the numericist problems. The real issue is, you know, first of all, the constraint-violating modes, and what can we do to understand those better? Yeah. That does go in there because it's perturbations. It's something which causes perturbations in your solution away from the constrained hypersurface. Peter?
Mm-hmm.
But those still satisfy the constraints.
Yeah, but they still blow up in a finite time. And so the time flow which goes outside the constraint hypersurface does not look very much different from the time flow which is inside the constraint hypersurface.
If I have two black holes in orbit,
yeah,
and they're going to make 10 orbits, if I stay close to the constraint hypersurface, where is the solution that's blowing up? I agree that in principle there are solutions that blow up in finite time, but I don't think that those are relevant to orbiting black holes.
But why could the solution blow up if I violate the constraint?
Because I'm not imposed, if I have a pure evolution scheme.
But it can still be a solution to the evolution equation which behaves regularly for all time.
Sure.
But we don't want that to happen. Yeah. That's the point.
I think there's worrying about the case where nothing goes up. Where it goes around for 10 orbits, but at the end of those first 10 orbits, the frequency is wrong by a factor of 2 because you're way off the constraint factor surface.
I think we're worried about
that's why I'm putting it in gauge mode. I mean, you're choosing the wrong gauge, and you get something's growing, which. No. We'll come back to this. Let's go on. So let's talk a little bit more about, if I'm just going to go through these, let's talk a little bit more about constraint violating modes. And we have a couple of questions. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you can't have a constraint violating mode and if the constraints are satisfied. Yeah. Well, it's one approach. That's one approach. Yeah. Yeah.
And we don't know what those boundary conditions are. That's
yeah.
And also, doesn't resolving the constraints introduce an extra error instead of pushing yourself back on the constraint?
Oh, yeah.
So,
but that should be an error that you can control with grid size. But I mean, the Mark's right. The big issue is if you're in a situation where you're doing grid excision, and you have these artificial boundaries, you and solving elliptic equations, you have to satisfy.
Okay, I'm glad that that's the only issue because I think we can solve those equations.
Oh. Yeah, but he has no inner boundaries. Well, I'm not certain that their boundary conditions exist.
Well, are they important?
Well, it's elliptic equations, they're essential. But we're talking, in this case, we're not talking about outer boundaries. We're talking about boundaries in the black hole where I don't think there are any boundary conditions. I mean, I know of one boundary condition, and you have to have at least four for the simplest case. And I don't know where you're going to get another boundary condition. I spent several months looking for them, looking at all kinds of different theories, and I couldn't find a boundary condition. So, I mean, let's go on. And I mean, if you can find a boundary condition, that's wonderful. But I don't think one exists.
Well, that's again the point. I mean, both along his lines and along your lines, mesh size are needed in this direction. And that's the question you want to pose. I mean, we need inner boundary conditions and what we need to have there. So
yeah.
I mean, I think this would be very helpful. If someone could be definitive on this point, are we wasting time looking for it? Can one rule it out? That one can try to can we cut an arbitrary hole at an apparent horizon inside a black hole or something? And is there no hope of putting boundary conditions there on a constraint that will allow us to solve Einstein's equations
with constraints?
I want to propose an answer to this question. I conjecture that you can find boundary conditions to enforce the constraint if you want to.
Well, I mean, you can always find a boundary condition by evolving the boundary, but I don't think that's going to be stable. When I say a boundary condition, I mean a one on first principles, not one by evolving it from previous slices, which is the only one I can see.
Okay, I think this is a really sharp little question. Yeah. Just the kind of thing you want this group to do is bring a problem that hopefully comes here at least to you to say there is no answer or there is the answer.
What decides what you should be choosing is determined by Michelson equation. So you should not rule out the use of Michelson equation in choosing your constraint, or the boundary of your constraint.
What is the matter with the idea? I mean, you're evolving, you're worried that you...
My guess is that it's going to be...
...violate the constraints, so you solve the constraints subject to the boundary conditions. You have some boundary conditions for the elliptic equation. You know what the boundary data is supposed to be, not the values of it, but...
Right.
The function that you're supposed to specify, right. You just choose those to be the ones
You just choose them from evolution. Yeah.
The
worry is it's going to be unstable.
Generic instability, then it must be due to something that departs from surface symmetry or something. I mean, because we have lots of evidence.
Yeah. But I mean, nobody knows the answer right now. But I think, but we have a well-posed question: what kind of boundary conditions do exist? Is it only evolved boundary conditions, or is there some first principle boundary condition that applies there? Yeah.
So how do you fix the boundary? Because I think if you allow the boundary to move around arbitrarily, you cannot expect to have a boundary condition there, because by just moving it a little bit, you change the boundary.
Yeah,
that is exactly what I think that's Greg's point.
Well, I think it's tied in there, yeah.
That's another way of asking the same question.
Yeah.
In fact, that's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
You might just ask for one question. I was going to keep in mind.
A precise formulation of the question is, If you make an arbitrary excision on the three-dimensional space-like hypersurface inside an apparent horizon, is there a first principle set of boundary conditions that can be applied to the Hamiltonian momentum constraints? Or is the only kind of boundary condition that you can apply there going to be obtained by evolving certain equations from previous slices up and using those as boundary conditions?
If you don't do that, you'll be changing your... If you don't use the data that you got from your evolution...
The boundary... any boundary condition would...
violating the evolution equation.
Well, any boundary condition would have to be consistent with it. But there is at least one boundary condition you can apply at any given point. I mean, if you take the apparent horizon equation, you take a time derivative of it, then you can choose some function to specify where the inner boundary of the horizon is, and by rewriting that time derivative of that apparent horizon equation, you can come up with a Roban-like boundary condition on the conformal factor, independent of the evolution. What you do understand is where the
evolution always gives you that value.
Mm-hmm.
Plus
your choice of where the horizon goes. But can you do something similar for something for the other constraints? I mean, you have that one, but I can't find three other boundary conditions on the.
That one, we do some equal situation.
Also, the apparent horizon can end. So you can try this evolution and you can try to run it through brick wall.
The apparent horizon can.
Any of them. I mean, they tend to come together like this, and then they just stop. So you have an apparent horizon for a while, and then the next time slice through it on.
Well,
Yeah.
And then the apparent horizon
jumps. Then you move your boundary out and you go again.
So you'll just do it again.
Yeah. So it's fine. No.
For the defining black hole problem, I think we could hope that there'll be two little apparent horizons for a while, and then maybe they'll die, but then there'll be a bigger round of one around it. So jump once, but perhaps only once.
The apparent horizon, in exactly the same picture as that in the painting where you might be starting with a well centered hole, the apparent horizon is so close to the real horizon that I would have thought that if you really want to do something, you go well inside the apparent horizon in order to set a boundary condition, because it's going to be wrong somehow, and the closer you are to the horizon,
You definitely want to go a little ways in. That's why I was saying you want to excise inside the apparent horizon, not at the apparent horizon, but inside it.
I think if it's inside, then I don't know how you want to think of Dr. Peter's question.
Well, you. But presumably you could do something along the lines of what you did, where you choose a surface where you have constant expansion of some value, and you're going to apply it there. Some surface of constant negative expansion, something like that. Okay. Why would it behave better? Well,
I mean, it could work better if
miraculously.
No, but I mean, if the evolution equations are exponentially driving you away from the constraint surface, then I could see that you would do better
by hammering yourself back onto the constraint surface every few times before you've got the control ready.
If the prescription is that.
So make up the prescription by stopping the hyperbolic evolution and then resolving the constraint.
Posing new
initial
data, this
miraculous
solution provide your boundary condition. It
presumably keeping also the constraint surface.
Now, also these contact.
Well,
okay.
I think we've got some more questions that will make you even more upset. So maybe we can move on to this.
We
should proceed to.
Well, I just want to point out there's another approach to that. I want to point out, but you could start with regular initial data for collapsing dust, consider the question, and then cut that off at some time.
You're saying to try. Well, it's connected, but it's not exactly the same thing. We don't want to go there. let me just see if I understood your point was, why not go and use an evolution where you have matter so that you don't have to worry about an inner boundary condition, at least for a long period of time? For a short period of time. Well, the problem isn't generating the initial data. It's during the evolution maintaining the constraints.
As you said, the initial data is really irrelevant.
Yeah. Okay.
The question by you, as a comment, there are some norm that if you just use a part of the evolution equation and solve the constraints on every slice, then the evolution equations which are not used run away exponentially. So if there is a complete symmetry in the constraints and then the evolution equation, so if you just use a part of the equation, you have the problem that the other equations have an exponentially growing violation.
Okay. All right. Well, let me make one more comment about constraints. Let's proceed a little bit. Okay, so concentrating still on constraint violating modes. Let me see what I want to say here. So we have a couple of examples where we have what seem to be reasonable sets of evolution equations, yet when you start using them, you find that you have growing modes, and these are not gauge modes, but they're these constraint violating modes, like Miguel showed in the case of the ADM equations versus the conformal ADM equations. He found several constraint-violating modes via this, and he analyzed them using this linearized analysis. And in the case of the Einstein-Ricci code, Mark made this nice analysis where he found, again, some constraint-violating mode. It was inherent in the continuum evolution equations. Okay. This seems to be a recurring thing where we have sets of evolution equations. They seem good, and they may even be well posed, but there's still problems with them. It would be nice if there were, some really good way of analyzing more fully what's going on with these equations. Yes.
Problem for the evolution of constraints, you can write down the energy for those
And sometimes, depending on the form of your evolution equation, that has nice evolution properties itself. I mean, and other times it doesn't. And so I think people should look at these, and you can differentiate the equations to get higher order energies as well. But it's always linear because the Yonke identities are linear and the constraints seem to align with yourself. And so I think there is a technique that people are exploiting.
We emphasize when we hear things about systems being well posed, and in general, what that means is that the growth of any errors or perturbations is no worse than exponential.
Right.
From a numerical point of view, if you say that to a numericist, they laugh at you.
Yeah.
The question is, we don't want to prove general theorems. We want to come with specific sets of evolution equations. We want to ask, is it possible to get a sharper bound? Can you analyze from first principles some given set? Give you even hyperbolic systems. Are there techniques where you can give a sharper bound and say, we know the growth is no worse than power law in time?
Because
if you can do that, that would be an extremely useful thing.
Yeah, thank you. That was my first caveat. Exactly that.
Well, some of the...
So there's that. The first caveat we had is, you know, what Saul just said. The other thing is a lot of the analyses which are done are only done on the principal parts of the equations, and frequently the problems that we've seen are not in the principal parts but in the right-hand sides. So we really need a full analysis. And then people do...
That's presumably where this exponential bound comes from. Right. That's the right-hand
side. Yeah. But I'm talking about different sets of analyses. You know, some of them where these bounds, you certainly are doing the...
Right? So when you look at the value problem, typically... If we wanted to, we could say that these equations are well posed. If we could bound, you know, give some bound is the norm of the data at any given time in terms of a constant factor times the initial data. Okay? You can define stability how you want it. Okay? So there's nothing magical about that exponential.
No, you end up writing a solution U is equal to something times U, and the solution is either e to the alpha.
That's correct. For a hyperbolic for propagation system, we could tighten it up and demand if we knew that
they would have to
blow up.
Then they would have to analyze the right hand side.
Right. But I mean, that's the stability analysis that the system is used in physics.
Not just the physical
system. The non physical. Yeah.
You raise that.
Maybe a useful way of thinking about well-posedness. Well-posedness has to do with the difference between ODE and PDE. So once you prove well-posedness, you're just in the same situation that you would be for ODE. And I, analyze the asymptotic behavior of a general ODE, you're not going to do that very quickly. So that's...
Certain bounds on metrics and symbols in the region space front, that you can go from that to bounds on the voters.
approach, Beverly and I looked at a cosmology, but I think it might help explain why Peter's results behave so well with respect to the Hamiltonian constraints, because we noticed that in a CNC sliced cosmology model, there's a good a term with good sign in the expanding direction wants to drive itself along the constraint back to the constraint surface. And you're in something not necessarily CNC, but once you're slicing this kind of similar to what we have, and you know, I think your energy thing being helped out by that term, that kind of thing.
Well, this brings us to the sort of part of the next point is that, and for example, the analysis which Mark did for stability of this one set of equations, the conclusions depended on the slicing we used, whether or not we were using a Kerr-Shield slicing or a harmonic slicing, you would get somewhat different answers. So one thing we've noticed about the various stability analyses we've seen is they're typically done either on flat space or on Schwarzschild, but the usual Schwarzschild slicing where it doesn't penetrate the horizon. And any analysis that's done, it needs to be done on a truly useful slicing like one of these which we're using, which is horizon penetrating. Okay. Oh, no uproar on that. Okay. Okay. All right, those were the main points on the stability for the constraint violating modes, and then coming back to the gauge modes, which is essentially choosing your coordinates, is back to the beginning where we started. So, I think that's been covered already, so I don't think I. I don't think there's really anything here to add to that. Okay. The last sentence, which some I think Doug already said, is you can't really separate all of these issues from each other. I mean, these issues with the gauge modes and the constraint violating modes, they're somewhat coupled together. I mean, you can try analyzing them separately, but it's not clear that you can analyze these constraint violating modes without choosing a specific gauge. So. You have to keep that in mind. Let's see. Beverly asked a question very early on about toy models, essentially, for testing things. And I don't really have a specific answer to that, but I can tell you that what we've done sort of as a general philosophy for attacking these problems so far, and it's a philosophy we were using all the way back in the Grand Challenge project. We started out looking at a Schwarzschild solution. You can do that in spherical symmetry, and then you can generalize. You can do spherical symmetry on a 3D grid as well, of course. But you try and tackle the problem of finding gauge conditions which work for a single black hole just sitting there, time independent. Find something which is going to work there. Once you get that tackled, then you try a boosted hole, and you find what you have to do to get that to work. So you can build up the complexity as you go along. Once you find a boosted hole, you try a spinning hole. What do you have to do to handle that? What sort of gauge conditions are useful there? Then you try them together. And eventually you see what do you have to do to deal with the tidal interactions. But I mean, you can build it up step by step. That's the general approach we want to take. And I think that's, I don't know of another way of breaking it down because these things are so coupled together.
There's one more slide here that I could put in. One way of testing coordinate conditions without having these other problems mixed in is not evolve the actual space time, just evolve the slice to a given space time. If you fix the space time, it needs not even be a solution to the asset equation. You put an arbitrary slice to arbitrary coordinate, and then you can see how that slice evolves given the gauge condition. With Miguel, I have implemented that.
So we test the slicing, but then you want to test the dynamics of your physics from that particular slice.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just saying you can actually test coordinate conditions independently of the stability of the underlying formulation,
the answer equation,
or boundary condition.
And we're not just your coordinate equation for something, but especially finally having equations for the coordinate, but having no equations for the coordinate.
Any help is greatly appreciated. The problem with that sort of approach is, I mean, these are coupled systems. So if you decouple it in this way, I mean, you might lose some of the behavior that you're looking for.
You mean if I lose the non-linearity?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, so... Yeah. I mean, we have done these partial analyses from time to time. I mean, so I think that we would like fuller analyses. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
The fuller, the better. We take the best that we can get. No, that's... Well, but it may be helpful. I mean, you can find certain modes. I mean, we have found certain modes that are not independent of the boundaries.
Yeah.
Well, you presumably know the speeds for the hyperbolic schemes anyway. But
you think you're doing that already?
Yeah. Yeah. So, so there's another good problem. Is what regime of possible schemes for specifying the lapse and the shift are compatible with these hyperbolic schemes?
Length of students.